This is the Human Rights 2020s podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This podcast is all about how we promote and protect human rights in Scotland.
We are delighted this morning to welcome Professor Nicole Busby from Glasgow University and Naomi McAuliffe from Amnesty International in Scotland to talk all about the Human Rights Act review. We have the privilege of listening in on their conversation about why it's important, some of the concerns and some things that we all need to think about. Over to you.
Hi, Naomi.
Hi, Nicole. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Very well. I wondered if we should start just by sort of, I always like to start by reminding myself about what the Human Rights Act is and what it does in practice. And then maybe we could move on to think about what the review is set out or has been set out to do. So I mean, I think it's important to remember that the Human Rights Act 1998 has been enforced since 2000. It incorporates the rights set out in the European Convention on Human Rights, which are civil and political in nature, and incorporates them into British law. And that has three main effects, which I mean, these are probably what we want to think about when we're thinking about what the review is going to do. I think they're all really important. They all kind of interrelate with each other. And the first of those is that breaches of the convention can now be heard by British courts. So the incorporation of the convention into the British law by the Human Rights Act means that claimants can take their cases to British courts and they can use the convention rights in making arguments before those courts. That's really important for a number of reasons, which we can maybe come back to. The second effect is that public authorities and organisations which carry out public functions must now respect human rights when carrying out those functions. Again, this has really been important in the development of all sorts of policies and practices around the public sector in particular, but also the private sector, where private sector organisations carry out public functions. And the third thing is that new laws should be compatible with human rights, and existing laws should be read as being compatible with human rights. There are some differences which I think are really interesting between the UK Parliament here and the Scottish Parliament. So the UK Parliament can pass laws which are incompatible, but the Scottish Parliament can't. So any act passed by the Scottish Parliament is not law to the extent that it is incompatible with the convention, because it's outside of the legislative competence of the Scottish Parliament, and the courts have what's called a strike down power. It means that they can deem that is not law. It's not legal. That doesn't apply to acts of the UK Parliament, and there the courts can make what they call a declaration of incompatibility. So if the courts find that something isn't compatible, they can state that in that declaration, but the law can still continue to apply. And that's really to protect British sovereignty. And I think that's really interesting to think about, because part of what the review at least is trying to do, or I think is intending to do, is to re-establish this idea of sovereignty. But actually, in my view, the Human Rights Act doesn't really challenge that in any way, particularly where the UK Parliament is involved. And where it does in relation to the Scottish Parliament, we haven't seen any really bad effects from that. In fact, it's been a very positive thing in Scotland. And so I do wonder, when we're looking at the remit of the review, whether it's necessary. You know, that's my first question. I don't know what your thoughts are, Naomi, but do we need to have this review focusing on sovereignty in particular, when there isn't really any threat to sovereignty that I can see under the Human Rights Act?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it does feel a bit like Groundhog Day, doesn't it? I mean, we've been dealing with kind of threats to the Human Rights Act for at least the last 10 years, if not before, where kind of successive governments have either wanted to review it or to repeal it or to replace it with a British Bill of Rights and Responsibilities, I think it was called at one point. And so now this is the kind of newest attempt, which is about this review. And as you say, it's about that kind of that fear that, you know, courts are getting involved with lawmaking rather than just kind of upholding the law. And I guess it goes back to quite a few specific cases where the governments got really annoyed that they lost. Because under the Human Rights Act, what generally happens is that it's the government or the state. You know, obviously the other manifestations like local authority level or a health board, but it's the government who's on the defence when in a human rights case. It's that entity, the state, that you're taking the case against. And so when any kind of state says, well, we want to try and curb your ability and your right to hold us to account, that should really cause us a huge amount of concern. And the fact that it doesn't, I think, is indicative of that it's happening against this backdrop of like anti-human rights rhetoric that has been going on for decades now and really undermining a lot of the public perception of human rights and conflating it with everything from kind of political correctness to health and safety. And you know when people, the general public, talk about human rights, they often think about, you know, prisoners being given fried chicken or people not being deported because they've got a cat and all of these like ridiculous stories that those of us who work in human rights know the details of that. But it still has left this kind of smear or stench around human rights and the idea that they're ridiculous and they've gone too far, whereas in fact they're such an important tool for holding the government to account, and we should really be suspicious of any attempt to try and dilute it in any kind of way. And yet here we are, we've got this new review which is trying to do that. It's trying to kind of curtail the ability of courts and ultimately of ordinary people to say that a law or a practice has infringed their human rights. So as you say, I'm massively suspicious of it, but we've got to kind of understand that context that it's happening within, and that, you know, there is unfortunately quite a lot of support for this out there.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, in the public perception, if in some ways, and again, this is fed quite often by politicians and the media, that human rights, you know, are sort of selective. They're for nice people who live good lives, but of course they're human rights. The whole point of them is that they're for everybody, and they should apply at least equally to everybody. And it doesn't mean that you can use them to escape justice. You know, to if you're a terrorist, it doesn't mean that you're going to get off the hook because, you know, you enforce your human rights. But you are entitled not to be subject to, you know, degrading and humiliating treatment.
And I think that so much of the kind of press reporting on so many of these cases, basically, if it's a bad or a negative case about people being deported, then it's human rights that are wrong. But there are so many positive cases out there where human rights law has been used for ordinary people, but it's never kind of framed as a human rights win. So things like, some of the cases that we're taking against the bedroom tax or against the, some of the litigation that has tried to be taken against the two-child cap on universal credit. There are so many of these like examples, but when they're reported, they're reported very truthfully, but they're not framed as a human rights story, which is what they are. Same with, you know, the Hillsborough inquiry. That only came about because of the Human Rights Act. Talking, Nicole, about how, you know, laws that go through the Scottish Parliament have to be in compliance with the Human Rights Act. And it did make me think a bit about how, because of this different way that the Human Rights Act is applied in England and Wales to Scotland, has that like led, do you think, to a different kind of culture up here? Because there's so many, when we talk to kind of colleagues or other people around the UK, it's almost like Scotland is this nirvana of human rights. There's all these like really positive things, the really positive stories, and not elsewhere. Do you think that's something to do with how the Human Rights Act is part of the Scottish Parliament?
I think yes and no. I think it's difficult you're right, we need to give these positive stories about human rights and the effect that they can have. And I think, you know, the human rights culture should be embedded in everything that a parliament in a modern democracy does, and everything that the executive does. And that is what the Scottish Parliament certainly attempts to do. So it's written into the operation, if you like, and the function of the Scottish Parliament in much more clearly than it might be in terms of the UK Parliament. That's probably to do with the time factor. You know, the Scottish Parliament is a newer institution. It was formed or reformed at a time when human rights were very much on the agenda. So I think all of those things help. And it doesn't mean, of course, that the UK Parliament and members of that Parliament are not aware about their role in upholding human rights. Lots of excellent work has happened there as well. But I think, yeah, it's smaller, it's newer. And I think that, you know, that certainly feeds into the idea that human rights should be embedded in everything that it does. And it has arrangements and provisions of that nature. But I do think we need to be careful. I mean, you made the point that, you know, people think of Scotland as some kind of human rights nirvana. There certainly is a stronger, I would say, a stronger human rights culture embedded in our kind of national institutions in Scotland. But I don't know that, you know, Scotland certainly has got a lot of work to do on its human rights record. I mean, you know, look at the Napier case, look at other Scottish cases that have come to light around human rights issues. And, you know, we know that Scotland is a very unequal society. And, you know, so we can't start being complacent, I don't think, about, you know, Scotland being, you know, a much more evolved nation in that respect than other parts of the UK. I think that's a kind of false idea. And I'm also quite cautious of this sort of competitive edge that seems to somehow creep in, particularly it may be a devolved nation thing, I don't know, but, you know, it's certainly we're going to be better at this than you are. Again, I'll come back to that point that human rights are for everybody. And so if there are human rights breaches happening in other parts of the UK, they matter as much to us in Scotland as they matter to the people who might, you know, who live in Wales or Northern Ireland or England. We've got to protect rights for all of us. And that's an international, you know, kind of obligation, if you like, as human rights defenders. So I think we've got to be careful of that. But yeah, it certainly is more transparently the case that human rights are sort of embedded in the practices of the Scottish Parliament. And I think that has helped. I think that certainly has made them more prominent. And I think it has helped to raise awareness of their importance. But you still speak to the public, as I did, particularly around the Brexit referendum. Members of the public will say, I don't see any point in the Human Rights Act. It's done nothing for me. There's nothing there for me. It hasn't improved my life at all. And I think that's an assertion that we really do need to take seriously, because people, I think, you know, people do confuse the EU and the European Convention on Human Rights. They are separate, but in the public's consciousness, they're kind of intertwined. And I think we need to really guard against that feeling of they're not for me. They're for terrorists, they're for prisoners, but they're not for ordinary people.
It's the thing that I was thinking about was, as we were saying, that these kind of threats to the Human Rights Act have been going on for quite a long time. And certainly our experience at Amnesty and campaigning for to save the Human Rights Act has been firstly working with kind of groups of politicians that are very pro the human rights framework from across the political spectrum. And this is something that, again, is really important for human rights in general, is to not politicize it, to not see it as just the preserve of one political party, but across the political spectrum. But also another reason why we feel that the Human Rights Act hasn't been repealed to this point, or hasn't been you know, kind of restricted or diluted in any way to this point, has been because of the devolved settlements, both the Scotland Act, Wales Act, also the Good Friday Agreement, and the fact that the Human Rights Act is referred to, and the European Convention on Human Rights are embedded in those documents, one of which is the international treaty, has been one of the things that has frustrated the any kind of repeal of it. So that kind of constitutional law aspect to this, that actually the setup of the UK at the moment is something that's stopped it happening. And therefore, if it does happen, is that going to have any kind of effect on devolution and on the parliament? So I don't know what you think about that in from a kind of constitutional law point of view. Is there real problems there?
Yeah, I think there are. I think that's absolutely right, actually, that analysis that we probably saw much more kind of proactivity around repeat. You know, the initial, I remember 2014, you know, the plan was that we were going to withdraw from the convention. You know, that was, and the Conservative government at the time made that quite clear that that was part of their agenda. That was then kind of pared back. Some of that to do with Brexit, I think, which sort of delayed everything around thinking about human rights and the future of human rights. But also, yeah, I think it hadn't really, it shows you quite often that the UK government don't really think too much about the devolution settlements when they make these great proclamations about things. Because when you look at that in you know, detail, it's actually quite difficult to do for all the reasons you give, that it does, you bump up then against these entrenched constitutional arrangements in the devolved nations, particularly Northern Ireland and Scotland. So I'm not particularly familiar with in detail with the sort of Northern Irish arrangements, but certainly in Scotland, I mean, but we know that they you know have got to be preserved as far as they possibly can be, with unless there's very good reason for doing otherwise. In Scotland though, we'd have to look at the Scotland Act, because the Scotland Act, I said at the beginning that the Scotland Act actually gives more prominence, if you like, to human rights in Scotland because of the strike down powers given to the courts, and the fact that this, which is to do with the fact that the Scottish ministers, the Scottish Parliament, cannot enact legislation which is incompatible with the convention. That's different from legislation that comes from the UK Parliament, which can be incompatible, and you know there are powers given to the courts about declarations of incompatibility, but not in terms of strike down. The courts don't have those powers. That's different in Scotland in relation to Scottish legislation. So the Human Rights Act and the Scotland Act are embedded, they work together in terms of our constitutional arrangements in Scotland. And so any repeal of the Act, certainly any withdrawal from the European Convention on Human Rights, but any repeal, or I would say even major amendment to the Act, would mean that they'd have to revisit the Scotland Act and the constitutional arrangements on which the Scottish Parliament operates. And that's a massive piece of work. You know, I'm not sure that that anybody actually at this stage wants to get into that, for all the sorts of reasons that we know about, to do with independence and current debates that are going on. So it's very complicated. And I think that did sort of, I think when that clicked, probably was the moment when the UK government said, okay, you know, now they say in terms of announcing the current review, there is no intention to withdraw from the European Convention on Human Rights, that's a given, that we're not going to do that. And I think it's not the only reason, but I think it's a big reason why they've kind of pared back on that and gone down this route of, well, we'll look at the Act itself in terms of what we can review, because that is domestic legislation. It's reserved to the UK Parliament. But I think even then that they have to proceed with caution around any amendment to that Act, because any major amendment certainly would impact on the Scotland Act and the arrangements in Scotland and the arrangements in Northern Ireland. And I think that has, you know, they're quite cautious in the language that they use in announcing the review and the remit of the review.
So this review panel, then, could talk a little bit about that. So it's got, you know, the chair of it's got various different experts on it from various different places, including some from Scotland. One of your colleagues is on this. So just talk a little bit more about that, about the kind of review panel, but also then, right, what should we do about this? You know, should we be submitting to this panel? Should we be kind of campaigning about it? I mean, what do you think is the right way to kind of interact with this panel as this kind of moves forward?
Yeah, I mean, there is a public call for evidence, so you can submit submissions. I think everyone should be doing that, and I think you know they should be a varying nature. Some of them quite specific about particular things that the Act does currently that are important for upholding the human rights of people in Scotland. And then also, you know, there are some quite general points that we can make about the devolution settlement, about the current arrangements, and also just about the fact that, I mean, I personally think it's not the right time to be doing this. And we can maybe talk about that, about the other challenges that government faces in when we get there, and we're not there yet, in the recovery from COVID. You know, appealing human rights is a really bad idea, even if it was ever going to be a good idea. In the current circumstances, it's a particularly bad idea to be unsettling current arrangements. So I think that everybody should be submitting to the panel, and the call for evidence was launched in January and is live, so you can do that now. I think it's broad. You know, you could respond in all different ways at all different levels, and that it's fairly narrow, their remit. You know, they're not asked to look at all aspects of the Human Rights Act, so they're asked to, or the review is focusing on the relationship between the domestic courts and the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, and the kind of dialogue that goes on there, and then also the relationship between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature. You know, again, there's a lot, and if you look at the way that the review's been framed, I think the framing is quite negative in lots of ways. It's almost saying there's something wrong with these two aspects, and that they need to be reviewed. And I would dispute that premise, because actually most experts, including the Equalities and Human Rights Commission and the Scottish Human Rights Commission, say in terms of what it's meant to do, the Act operates pretty effectively. You know, it's fit for purpose. There isn't really any need to be looking at.
I think that's such a strong point. And I think for people who are responding to the Human Rights Act review panel, the now is not the time is so strong. Like, we are all having to cope with so much at the moment. There's going to be this whole COVID recovery. We're going to have to do a hell of a lot more building back. And as you've explained, to do all of this on top of it is just, it's too much, and it won't work because of it. And as you said as well, other kind of key points to have in people's responses is these specific examples of where the Human Rights Act has worked in your area of work, like some good specific examples. I think, again, it's that kind of evidence rather than we like the Human Rights Act and we think it's good. Cold hard evidence is really important with that. And again, just to ignore that negative framing, to look at actually these are where we want to go further, this is what we want to improve, these are and to give those kind of examples of actually getting more human rights and more human rights protections and not regressing. But I also think that's such an important point, that as you said it's been framed in terms of the interactions between the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive, i.e. the UK government or you know, government ministers. And in fact, you know, so many organisations responding to this will have so many examples where it's got nothing to do with central government. It's actually to do with the kind of policies and procedures at local government level. And that's where so much of this work goes on and where so much of the interaction is. And so that is something that actually needs to be worked on in terms of making the Act work better at local level, rather than, you know, what the UK government seem to be obsessed with, which is basically the prorogation case that they didn't like, and a few other times when, you know, high profile cases when they've wanted to deport people. Actually, the main work of the Human Rights Act happens at a local level, and that's where we want to see more capacity building and more training going on, rather than, you know, this obsession with what is actually a very small part of how the Act works and really isn't relevant to most people's lives. So if organisations can kind of get back with that message about how they use it and how they see it working, I think that would be a really good way of kind of trying to combat some of these changes that that clearly the government wants to do to avoid accountability.
Thank you, Nicole and Naomi, for that enlightening discussion, and thank you, listeners, for listening to this episode of the Human Rights 2020s podcast, produced by the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. For more information on the Human Rights Act and the independent review, you can visit the consortium website. at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at HRC Scotland. Thanks very much.